Hello, everybody. I want to first open with an abject apology. I misread the time of this lecture. I thought I was supposed to start at 5:30 my time, which is Pacific time. I'm in Los Angeles. It's actually supposed to start at 3:30, and I've had Lou Rockwell, Pat Barnett, and a friend of mine, George Resch, all calling to wonder what's wrong, and I made a mistake. I got the time wrong. Fortunately for me, it's not a mistake in praxeology. So I think I'm all right. And we'll just go. I'll just give. An extra time. I hope we won't have this problem in future because I rarely make the same mistake twice, unless, of course, aside from the occasions where I do make the same mistake twice. Well, I mean, now probably Danny's already given most of my lectures better than I could do it, but we'll find out. Now, for those of you who haven't attended Mises Academy courses before, let me explain a bit, or attended any of my courses. I'm always surprised, incidentally, when people repeat, take more than one course from me and think they would have learned the first time not to do it anymore, but I do get, I'm very pleased that there are a lot of people who do come. Then maybe if we get through the lecture, I'll be able to figure out why I got the time wrong. But, all right, so what we do in the lecture, I usually lecture for about an hour or so, and then the rest of the time, is half hours for discussion and questions. You can also put questions during the lecture in the chat room. Now, the way I've organized the course, you see, 8 lectures, and the first part of Human Action consists of an introduction in 7 chapters. So this suggested to me a good way of organizing the lectures. We'd have a lecture first on the introduction, and then a lecture each week on one of the chapters. Seems like a simple way to do it. Now, there's one thing that will be somewhat easy for you, or easier than some other courses. Because we're only covering 142 pages in this introduction plus the 7 chapters, there isn't that much reading for each week. You could figure out what the average is by dividing 8 into 142, but of course, we don't do math in Austrian economics, so you'll have to do that on your own. That's a joke. You're supposed to laugh at this point. So what we'll be doing each week is going over one chapter. Now, for those of you who are interested in taking the course for credit, there's going to be I have a weekly quiz which consists of 10 multiple choice questions. These are quite easy. I don't like to trick people. I mean, it's not as if I'm writing a book review, or of course what you're trying to do in a book review is destroy the person whose book you're reviewing. That's not what I'm trying to do here. Book reviewing is a blood sport, but not giving lectures. I feel if you're taking my course, you're my friend, so I want to make it easy. So one reason we're having a whole course just on one section of the book, 142, sounds like an odd idea to have a course on just 142 pages, is that these aren't easy pages. In fact, a lot of people will say they like to read Human Action because it's one of the greatest books on economic theory ever written. They think, well, they really want to understand Austrian economics, so they want to, this is Mises' greatest book, so they want to read it. But then they start reading it and they find all this very complicated philosophical discussions and all sorts of discussions of various things. So they say, well, this is too hard, and as a result, they put the book away. Now, one thing you could do is just say, ignore the first 142 pages and then just try to do the rest of the book. If you do that, you won't be doing things Mises' way. So what my aim in this course is to try to explain this first part in an easy to follow way, and I think I can do that. And sometimes people say my lectures are too complicated, but of course no one who enrolled in this course would say something like that, at least I hope not. So what I want to do in the lecture today is just go over some of the points in the introduction. Mises makes, and one thing we'll find in the introduction is very important to read the introduction, because we'll see what he does in the introduction is give some themes very briefly in the introduction that he'll be explaining at substantially greater length in the rest of part one, sometimes in other parts of the book. So if you study the introduction, you'll get a good idea of what's coming next. Now, in the introduction, Mises makes what appears to be a surprising claim. He says that economics is the newest science. So we might wonder, well, is that really true? Aren't there all sorts of newer sciences than economics? Say, economics really came in, as if you agree with Murray Rothbard, with the Spanish scholastics, but it's developed as really this in the modern sense, as we know it, really in the 18th century. But haven't there been sciences since then, such as neurobiology, astrophysics, computing science? Haven't there been newer sciences in the 18th century? So how can Mises say economics is the newest science? What his answer to that, and one thing you'll find when reading Mises, if you think of objections to what he said, he's usually thought of them already and he has responded. He says, well, if you take the sciences like the ones I mentioned, they're just developments of already existing science. So if you take neurobiology, it's just a development of biology and the study of the brain. Those were already, people were already studying them, and people now just get more and more specialized fields, and they have become independent disciplines. They break off from the old discipline. They become just a separate science, but they're not coming up with any really new method of inquiry. They're just the same, they proceed in the same way as other science. Astrophysics is really applying physics say, the composition of stars, but you're not really changing the basic way you investigate things in physics. There is a method where you have theories that you test out by and then do experiments. Now, someone gives examples, quantum mechanics and computer science. Well, these are all very good examples of new sciences, but again, they're just using, or at least means that they're just using very similar methods to what was already in use in, say, physics or various kinds of mathematics already. So, like Mises says, is unique. What makes economics new is that it uses a different method from that of the existing physical sciences. And what his principal aim is in part one of Human Action, which is what we're going to study, is to explain what that method is and to justify it. And we won't be getting into this in this lecture, but this is where all the complicated stuff about a priori true propositions comes in, the synthetic a priori, and all that sort of thing. And that's the part that people have a lot of difficulty with, so that's what we're going to be trying to explain. Now, someone, I guess it's a fun rise from a deterministic universe to a probabilistic one. So you see, that may well be, but that's just a conclusion, that's a result of the science, but it isn't a new method. So that's why Mises would say that doesn't give us something new, and this is why he says economics is using a new method, so that makes it the newest science. Now, as I mentioned before, but we'll just go over again, I'm afraid I agree with the character in Lewis Carroll's Hunting of a Snark, who says, what I tell you three times is true, but for a very much larger number than that. Issues of method are extremely important for me. He devotes a great deal of time to them. So somebody says, well, why we have to bother with these difficult methodological issues, he really isn't being true to the spirit of Human Action. When you read a book, particularly a great book like Human Action, you have to really try to think yourself into the author's point of view. So if you have the attitude, well, I don't care about all this stuff with methodology, this is kind of philosophical, hair splitting, it's really not that important, you won't be really studying things from a Keynesian point of view. If you want to get into the spirit of Human Action, you really have to do it this way. You have to study what Mises says about methodology in this first part, and my job is to try to make it a little easier for you. Now, Mises says that there's this new method of studying that economics is the result of the way of studying human actions, because it uses a different method from that of the sciences. But one thing this is very true, you'll see throughout Mises' work, he always develops his views in contrast with other positions. Now, there have been other attempts besides that of economics to try to explain human action in a way that's different from the sciences. Mises mentions there have been attempts by various philosophers of history. We could mention people like the 19th century German philosopher Hegel, the 20th century people like Arnold Toynbee, Oswald Spengler, who said that history as a whole has a certain goal or direction. So what these philosophers of history would be saying is there's really a pattern in history, just say when you read a novel, there's a plot to it that the author has put in. There's a plot really to history, not plot in the sense of somebody plotting some sort of conspiracy, it just there's a narrative structure that explains all of history. So both philosophers of history agree with Mises when Mises said human action has to be studied in a different way from the way the physical sciences are studied, but they don't use the method of economics, and we've seen what that method is. They say there's a narrative structure to all of history. So Mises says, well, these philosophies of history are mistaken because they depend on the view that there is a collective entity, which we can call history or the nation, which has goals, the civilization, as if these are entities that have goals. And a fundamental principle, as we'll see in later lectures, of praxeology, which is the study of human action, is methodological individualism, which is only particular people act. So, supposing someone said, as Hegel did, that the goal of history is the realization of freedom. It's the absolute mind coming to realize itself. Now, if you don't find that very meaningful, never mind, Hegel is extremely difficult to figure out. But what Mises would object to in that, and he does object to the theory of history, is this, to say that is assuming there's some kind of entity apart from particular people who have the goals, the absolute mind. And Mises doesn't accept that. So he says these theories of history are all wrong because they say there is something apart from individuals who are acting. Again, basic principles, remember, methodological individualism, only individuals act. Now, one thing that Mises is particularly anxious to emphasize in the introduction, and will come up in other parts of other chapters in this first part, is that there's a lot of opposition to economics as he practices it. Remember, he's saying economics has come up with this new method that makes it the newest science, but a lot of people oppose economics. They don't like economics. What he Mises tries to do is to explain why people resist economics and get to the source of their opposition. And one of the great obstacles to economics is the view that what happens in society is completely up to us. And there are a lot of people who don't like this idea. They think that, say, supposedly we're trying to decide how should society be organized. So then what some people think, and there are many political and social philosophers who think this way today, say, well, we just have to think about what are the appropriate standards for society, what makes a just society. For example, a lot of people, political philosopher G.A. Cohen was a Marxist, said, well, in a just society, really people should be equal in some sense. It's unfair if some people make a lot more money than others. So what these philosophers think is what we're trying to do is come up with the correct principles, say, of who should get what amount of money, how things should be distributed. Now, economics doesn't say that those people are wrong to think that, but it does impose certain limits in this sense, that in economics there are definite laws that limit what we can do. For example, suppose somebody says, well, I think it's unfair that workers sometimes don't earn very much money, so we should pass minimum wage laws that says everybody should earn a living wage, where a living wage is set pretty high. Now, economists can't say that view is wrong or shouldn't do that, because economics doesn't make the value judgments. It's a science just trying to explain something about the world. It isn't telling us what we ought to do, but it does say if you impose minimum wages that are higher than what the market would have established, you're going to have unemployment. So this is an example of something that limits what people can do. Suppose somebody said, well, we want to have high minimum wages but no unemployment, you won't be able to do that. So a lot of social reformers and philosophers, other people, don't like the idea of limits to what we can do. They have a view that society should really, it's up to us to organize society the way we want. Say in the physical world, we can't make things the way we want. Suppose somebody said, well, I don't like the idea of the sun coming up every day. Well, there's nothing you can really do about that, just the way things are. But a lot of people think, well, the social world isn't like that. It's completely up to us what we should do. And economics shows that isn't the case, but really there are limits. So this is a big source of opposition to economics, these things. Now, I call this view moralism, namely that society should be organized according to appropriate moral principles, and there's no real limit to what people can do according to these principles. So that, as I say, a big source of opposition to economics. Now there's a more sophisticated version of moralism. There aren't probably that many people around who think there are no economic laws at all, really. Absolutely everything is completely up to us. But there are some people who say who don't reject economics altogether, but they say economics applies only to the money-making aspects of life. And asking should be aspects. I must not have been thinking. Yeah, I don't like to make typographical errors, but I can't see them too well in my own work. It's just in other people that I can see them. So this view is, well, economics will explain certain things about people's life, but not others. Sometimes people will bring in the concept of homo economicus, economic man. Always sounds better if you say something in Latin, people think you're educated. So what this view is, well, economics can explain some things about human life, but not other things. So why would people say that? Well, then they can say, all right, economics might have laws, but these laws really are just part of what we have to consider in studying human beings. We have to take account other aspects of human life as well, not just the money-making aspect. And if we do that, it might be that the economic laws are overridden by other considerations. There is a very popular view, for example, there's a currently popular trend called happiness research, where people are interested in that. It's like, well, just getting material goods isn't really going to make us that happy. Maybe a certain, the free market will work for getting us material goods, but that's not so important. We need to have the government come in and help us lead a good life. So you see, this is the example of this particular view, because those people say, well, economics is just dealing with this, how do people get wealthy, how they amass material goods, but that is just part of life. So Mises says, Mises doesn't accept that. In his view, economics is covered, basic principle of economics, science of human action, covers not just people's pursuit of material goods, but it covers everything. It covers all our choices. But, and now here we get to, again, one of the key themes in human action. Mises said that 19th century economics, which was basically the economics of David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill, didn't really have the resources to counter the modified rejection view. So economics in the 19th century couldn't really answer those who said economics is only, can only explain people's pursuit of material goods, people's pursuit of money, but it can't explain our non-monetary goals. So, say you can explain, say, why people work in order to get money to buy things, but they couldn't explain why people will give up work for leisure or other things that are not directly having to do with material goods. Now, why couldn't 19th century economics do that? Why couldn't it explain all the choices? And Mises said it couldn't because it had a cost of production theory of value. It would explain, say, suppose you say, why do apples cost a certain amount of money? So the 19th century theorists would say, well, it costs this amount of money because it takes you so many hours to work to grow an apple, and so you have to have seeds by seeds and other things, you have to plant them. So it explained everything in terms of cost of production. But you can't really apply cost of production to people's demand for non-material goods. So you can't say, so I say, I'd like to go on a vacation, say, it would be a good place to go, some place nice. I suppose I say I want to go to Beirut or Damascus, someplace to be, I could have a nice, peaceful vacation. So we wouldn't be able to explain that sort of choice in terms of cost of production. So cost of production theory wouldn't be dealing with all the choices that people make. So because it's not able to explain all the choices that people make, it can't counter the objection that economics deals with only one aspect of life. So you see how the argument goes there. The view is that the claim is economics just deals with one aspect of why we are wanting to get material goods, and then suppose somebody says, no, that isn't right. Economics deals with all our choices, with what Mises once said. But you can't say that if you adopt just a cost of production theory of value, because then you won't be able to explain a lot of preferences, a lot of choices that people have. So in order to counter this objection, namely that we want to explain all choices, not just our aiming for material goods, we need to have a subjective theory of value. What do we mean by this? It's a theory that explains value in terms of the preferences that people have. You explain the, say, the value of a vacation in terms of people's wanting to have a vacation in the peaceful places like Beirut or Damascus. We're supposed to laugh at that the other time. But I don't know how many people did. I expect people to laugh at my joke. I won't make it an absolute requirement, of course, but it's certainly desirable. All right, so you need a subjective theory of value to do this, because you won't be able to explain all choices just with a cost reduction theory. Now, how do you develop a subjective theory of value? According to Mises, you need to use the proper method, and we'll be seeing in the subsequent lectures what that method is, but it's basically just thinking about the concept of human actions and what's implied in the concept of human action. So you need to have a subjective theory of value in order to explain all human choices and thus respond to this objection that economics just deals with one aspect of life. And to develop a subjective theory of value, you need to use the proper method. And this is one reason then that methodological issues are so important, because if you don't develop methodological issues correctly, don't have the correct method, you won't be able to get the proper theory of value. And also Mises thinks, if you use this proper deductive method, you'll be able to understand economic calculation. What is economic calculation? Then we'll be getting into this more later. It's basically where you consider various choices that you're making, and the ones that you can, you assign a value in money to the various choices, and then ones that you can't value in money, you can at least see how much money you'd have to give up to get what you want. So if you need to, and this one basic theme to Mises economics, you need to, businessmen, other people in the market need to calculate economically in order to decide how to use resources efficiently, and we can explain economic calculation if we have the correct method of understanding economics. Now, here, just some points on terms. Mises says that he's dealing with a general science of human action that he calls praxeology. So one point to note here is that sometimes you'll see praxeology as meaning this deductive method, but that isn't actually the way Mises defines praxeology. Praxeology is the science of human action. It uses a deductive method, but the method isn't the praxeology. Praxeology is the science, you see, the distinction. So you can speak of a method, deductive method, in studying praxeology, but it isn't the method that's the praxeology. And then there's another word, a funny word called catalactics. Sounds like, when you read it, you think it's something like, well, maybe it's a, sounds like ex-lax, but it isn't. That would just be, it's a study of exchange. And this is part of praxeology. Mises likes, sometimes would like to coin somewhat unusual terms, but just important thing to remember, just these two, they're all in one study. Catalactics is study of exchange, and it's part of praxeology, which is the study of human actions. Now, we've mentioned so far one source of opposition to economics, which is, remember, the view I call moralism, which is that if you have economic laws, then this is going to limit what people can do in planning a good society. A lot of people don't like this. And then there's a more sophisticated position, say, which would say, all right, there are economic laws, but they just cover one aspect of life, so we don't, they still have to be considered in relation to other aspects of life. They aren't really comprehensive. They can be superseded by higher laws when you take account of the full picture. You cannot accept it as part of the picture. So, and again, reason, I'll say, no, that's wrong. Economics explains all of our choices. Now, I now deal with another source of opposition to economics that means stresses, which is the view that economics must follow the method of the physical sciences. Remember, Mises said economics is the newest science because it has this different method from the physical sciences. So some people say, no, the only acceptable method of studying anything is the method used in the physical sciences. So since praxeology doesn't use that method, the deductive method, it's condemned as unscientific. So what Mises says there is, well, that isn't really a good way of proceeding. What you shouldn't insist that a subject follow some preconceived idea of method on the grounds that only this method is scientific. What you should do is just adopt the method that's appropriate to study whatever you're interested in, but you shouldn't say, well, here is the method, doesn't matter what the subject is, this is the correct way of doing things, this is what science is. And in another book that Mises wrote called Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science, which was really his last major book, he mentions a claim by the philosopher science Karl Popper, who is like Mises from Vienna. And Popper said a scientific statement has to be falsifiable. You have to come up with some way the statement could be false, and if you can't do that, it's not scientific. And since the claims of praxeology are supposed to be universally true, they couldn't be false. So it would seem on Popper's view then, praxeology couldn't be a scientific discipline, because remember, scientific discipline, one that you could say how the statement could turn out to be false. For example, suppose I say all professional basketball players are over 6 feet tall. Well, you can see how that could turn out to be false if we find someone who's a professional basketball player who's under 6 feet tall. I think there have been some of those. But if you take some statement from praxeology, or if you take the statement, you always select your highest value choice. If the praxeological reasoning is correct, that couldn't turn out to be false. We couldn't have a situation where someone doesn't select his highest value choice. So it seems Popper would have to say, well, then Austrian economics is not scientific because you can't come up with a way that that statement could be false. What Mises says there is, well, why should that matter? Why should we just set up some kind of statement and say, here's what science is. If you don't pass this test, you're not scientific. Why should we care about that as long as we have a good way of getting knowledge? In fact, what we should do is try to determine what is scientific by looking at the actual ways of attaining knowledge that we have. We shouldn't just say, here's what the correct way to proceed in all disciplines. We must have a hypothesis and try to test it out. And if we can't come up with a way of testing that's not scientific, we should just go according to what actually gives us knowledge in the real world, not according to some preconceived philosophy. Now, there's another source of opposition to praxeology. I see Danny Sanchez referred to this a little before in the comment. It was the German historical school, Mises calls it sometimes the Prussian historical school. And this group held that economics couldn't arrive at general law, so all that we could do, say, would be study things like prices in Bavaria in the 18th century, the historical studies of one of the great, the historical school, Gustav Schmoller, was noted for his studies in economic history. Werner Solberg was another one. These people do a study, particular periods of economic history, and mass up a lot of data on them. But they thought there weren't any general laws of economics. We couldn't come up with them, at least until we collected a whole lot of facts about particular entities, particular economic events. So one of general laws, we're not really ready for that. All we have to do is collect historical data. And why did they take that position? What motivated them? Well, Mises thinks, again, they were against the free market. They didn't like, just like this group I call the moralists, they didn't like the idea that the state intervention can be shown not to work. They were very strong proponents of a strong state, a powerful state that regulated the economy. So they were attracted to the view that there aren't economic laws that will say these measures like protective tariffs or wage laws will not advance the welfare of the people, but they're harmful. They didn't like that, so they opposed the notion of economic law. Now, there's a more extreme expression of this, I call this other position, German historical school, you can call historicism, denying that there are general laws in history or economics. Now, there's a more extreme expression of historicism, which Mises calls polylogism. Then he likes sometimes these rather odd terms, praxeology, catalactics. There's another one, polylogism. I guess you would, if you read the book, you at least, one thing will at least expand your vocabulary. So polylogism is the view that all knowledge, not just economic, but all knowledge is relative to race and class. So on a polylogist view, suppose I say, what's the speed of light? A polylogist view would say, well, the answer to that depends on what your social class is or what your race is. There isn't an answer to it just absolutely, but the answer is relative to something. And Marxists thought knowledge is relative to economic class, and the Nazis thought knowledge is relative to race. So these would be examples of polylogist view. Let me just go over it again because it sounds a bit, it is kind of peculiar view. They ordinarily, if we say, say something is true, I suppose you say, I'm now giving a lecture, probably many of you wish I wasn't, but we say, well, that's true. It's the case that I'm giving a lecture now. But on a polylogist view, you couldn't say I'm giving a lecture and that's the end of it. It would be that's true relative to what? You'd have to bring in this extra variable, class or race or possibly something else, if you wanted to say something is true. It wouldn't just be, here's your statement, it's true, the facts are as the statement says they are, and false if they're not, but you'd have to bring in this extra thing, the race or the class. So, again, Mises stresses the motive for polylogism is opposition to the conclusions of economics. Say the Nazis said, well, economists who don't favor their kind of state planning, it's really, they raise objections, this is really an example of Jewish economics. So then it's no good. The correct Aryan economics would support them. So Mises suggests one motive for adopting polylogist views is that this opposition to the conclusions of economics. I see Daniels put an appropriate quotation from Mises. In the eyes of the Marxians, Ricardian theory of comparative cost is spurious because Ricardo is a bourgeois. The German racist condemned things because Ricardo was a Jew, and the German nationalist because he was an Englishman. Some German professors advanced all these three arguments together against validity of Ricardo's teaching. Well, I guess if you can have three arguments supporting your view, that's usually better than just one, but if they're all wrong, it doesn't help you very much. So the polylogist view is supposed to extend to the physical sciences, not just economics. There was a Nazi physicist, Leonhard, that's a Nobel Prize winner, a great experimental physicist, who wrote a book, multi-volume book, called German Physics. So, again, this view is that physics is relative to race. But in practice, means that people will accept the results of the science and they don't claim they're just relatively true. So what polylogism is really aiming at is an attack on economics. Now, what, supposing we have these views like polylogism, German historical school, this view that economics should follow the method of physical sciences. It doesn't. It's wrong. So what should economists do when economics is subject to attack of this kind? Now, one view is that economists shouldn't respond to attacks on the possibility of economic knowledge. Economists should just go about their own business and ignore these mistaken ideas. And Mises has a beautiful quotation from Spinoza's Ethics, which he gives in Latin, which could be used to support this view, where he says, just as light is the measure of darkness, so is truth the measure of itself and falsity. And do they have, I think there's some guide called Mises Made Easier. Do they give you in that a translation of this Latin phrase? I don't know, I just used this my own translation. Is this, do they actually give you the translation of this in that guide? I didn't check that, but this is what the phrase means. So this view would say, well, you should just ignore these wrong attacks. This isn't the view you need to take, but I just mentioned Spinoza because one thing you'll find periodically in Mises' writings, you'll find this quite a bit in human action, Mises quote Spinoza quite a bit, and I would suggest there's a, for people who are interested in doing research on Mises, a topic that would merit investigation is how much Mises was influenced by Spinoza. I think that you might come up with more than you would think there. But Mises doesn't accept this particular application of Spinoza. He says that it's essential to that economists reply to critics. And what he tried to do in his methodological work, and this is one of the main things we have to bear in mind, we try and understand part one of human action, is that Mises is defending economics against those who criticize it. I see Danny's put up this translation. I think this is a beautiful phrase, don't you think? It's a wonderful thing Spinoza said he had it. He's such an eloquent writer sometimes. Now, one other attack on economics that Mises considers, I want to mention, discussing in this introduction, is that, and you'll find a lot of people say this today, is that economics hasn't made much progress compared to the physical sciences. People say things like, well, economists can't even cure depression, say we're in a recession now, economists can't tell us how to get out of it, but physical sciences can do things like we can go to the moon, we can build atomic weapons, we can build all sorts of machines and devices that we didn't have hundreds of years ago. So doesn't this show that economics is backwards compared to physical science? But what Mises says here is that this reflects the false view that economics has to be governed by the standards and methods of other sciences. And he says, no, that's not right. It just has to be governed by its own standards and methods. Now, another criticism that's really related to what I've said just now is that economics hasn't been able to bring about prosperity for everybody. as I say, haven't been able to predict and cure depression. So what Nita says there is, well, economists can't really help it if people ignore their advice on policy measures. Say if economists say tariffs will not work in raising everyone's welfare, and then people put in tariffs anyway, it isn't really fair then to say, oh, well, economics isn't helping people to achieve prosperity, when the advice of economics, of economists, has been ignored. And also important to bear in mind that the free market, which came about in part through the ideas of economists, has had a great effect in raising living standards since the Industrial Revolution. So Mises' answer to this claim that economics isn't really any good because it hasn't shown everybody the way to prosperity is that it has had a lot of beneficial effects to the extent that the ideas of economists on virtue of the free market have been put into effect, and economists aren't responsible if people ignore what they say. Now, one thing we have to be a bit careful here, and I wasn't fully careful in what I said just now, is that economics is a descriptive and not a normative science. It's trying to explain the world and not tell you what you should do. It says, here is how people, prices are determined, here is how people will decide what to do given their preferences. It isn't telling you, you should prefer this, and you should prefer this. However, this is really getting in certain things that are very much like normative statements, even though they're not. It can tell you the consequences of various policy statements. It can't tell you, don't institute protective tariffs, don't have protective tariffs. But it can say, and this is a descriptive thing, if you enact a protective tariff, it will harm the welfare of consumers who don't have to pay higher prices for goods. So where it's kind of sneaking normative conclusions in, again, it's not making them, but given preferences that people have, then it's very likely people will take these statements to be telling them what to do. It's just, I just maybe let me explain in a simple way. Supposing your doctor said to you should stop smoking because it's bad for your health. He's making a descriptive statement, smoking is bad for your health, but most people will want what's good for their health. So the doctor is giving you a reason to stop smoking. So similar here, the economist isn't saying you should absolutely do this or you shouldn't do that. The economist is describing the world, but given the fact that, say, most people want prosperity, they don't want to be poor, then the economist is giving a strong reason to adopt certain policies. So, okay, I think I'll stop now, and the rest of the time, you can put questions either in the chat or type them in this Q&A box that I'm now going to open. Again, I want to apologize. I'm sorry I got the time of the lecture wrong. I had several people that they call and ask if I was all right. In fact, when I had all these people call me, seeing if I was all right, I wondered if I really was all right. But here, anyway, I think we've solved the problem. So I'm going to the Q&A thing, and then you can either type your questions in there or in the chat. going on in the chat too. Now here's one from Neil. Mead is cited to Professor Chiral, eccentric Nazi physician. Just how many Pilotus were there under the Nazis? Well, it was quite a popular view of sort of racial theory. The most famous of the Nazi theorists on race was Hans F.K. Gunther. And he wrote a number of books on racial typology. Some of them didn't stress different logical systems. They just thought people of different races would have different values. But some people did take his Pilotus position. Neil continues, does anyone really think the 2+2 is racially based? Well, probably, I would suspect, not simple propositions like that, but there were Nazi mathematicians who said, well, their characteristic Jewish ways of defining infinity, there's kind of a Jewish mathematics, say, that stressing certain kinds of abstractions, whereas Aryan mathematics is more rooted in the concrete. This is one of the not the objections to Einstein's general relativity. They would say, well, Einstein is really defining matter as if it's purely geometric, and this is a characteristic of the Jewish kind of thinking. So there were people who took that, that usually wasn't just coming up with a straw man here, but there were people who took that view. Andrew asked, if you could narrow down the most influential criticism used by Posner against obtaining real knowledge by deductive method, what would it be? Well, this will be going into more detail in some later lectures, but basically what they would say is if you're using the deductive method, say you're just talking about concepts, all you're really coming up with is further statements about concepts. And suppose I say it follows from all bachelors or unmarried males that there are no female bachelors. So all I'm doing there is just explaining how certain deductive concepts about how certain concepts are used. But the positive state, if we want to have knowledge about the real world, that concerns how the concept is applied to the world. And we can't find that out just by thinking about concepts. We can't tell what's really going on in the world unless we investigate the world by using our senses. And so that's the claim. I think that's probably the most important argument against praxeology that needs development. And we'll be trying in some of the future lectures to answer that if we can. Now, Mark asked, can we strictly economics reach conclusion like the following? The stock of company XYZ is overvalued. There is irrational exuberance in financial market at this time. Or are those judgments normative? Well, I think you could have judgments of that kind because you would be taking saying that they're overvalued to mean overvalued in the sense that it's given that people hold the value stock at this rate, it's likely that the stock won't be able to maintain itself at that rate. It will collapse. So that's just a statement of what you think will happen given the fact that certain people hold certain values of stock. But you're not saying that people shouldn't value stock in that way. You're saying given that they do value the stock in that way, something's going to happen. And when there's a rash exuberance in financial markets, again, that would just be saying that people are optimistic and they think the market's going to keep going up and they're likely to be wrong, but again, this is saying people shouldn't have such views, it's just that that's what's likely to happen if they do. Daniel says you mean praxeology is science, not the method. And you clarify really that praxeology is the method, not deduction into the sin. Well, and praxeology is the science of human action, and Mises, the way Mises conducts his science, it's to start with a concept of action. People act, people use means to achieve the end, and we see what's involved in that concept. We try to draw out what's involved in that concept. So that's really what we'll be going into that in some of the future lectures. Okay, now Steve says, is it somewhat the thing of good book on German historicism and its impact on Islam? Well, I think, I don't know if it's in the Mises bookstore, but you should look at, say, in the Joseph Schumpeter History of Economic Analysis, has a lot of discussion of German historical school. I think that would be a good one to look at. There's a short monograph by Mises on the German historical school and its impact. You can get that in the Mises bookstore, that's it. Now, Jim says, I agree with the statement that economics and descriptive science, but should we not draw the difference between descriptive and empirical versus descriptive and normative? My understanding of normative is the approach that applies judgment. Well, I mean, you can have judgments about that the world is constituted a certain way. I mean, judgment, as I would use it, would be just statement, expression, some kind of proposition, but I'm not, maybe you could say a little more detail what you have, and I'm not really getting it. Normative would be telling you what you should be doing, what ought to be the case, and descriptive would be what is the case. Now, empiric wouldn't have descriptive, wouldn't have to be empirical, but somebody could say, well, there are non-empirical statements describe the world. Also say there are things that we can learn about the world that aren't saying how the world should be. They just say, the world is this necessarily, is a certain way. That's one of the claims that's made in praxeology, but that wouldn't be a normative statement, even though it's not empirical, you see. Okay, now let me just go up. I see there's some in the chat. Wait a sec here. David says, has anyone developed praxeology in any areas other than economics? Well, not all that much. I mean, I think there was some people have had the idea of praxeology of violent action, but I don't think people have really done all that much in other areas than economics. It's been suggested, but not really that much has been done in other areas. Okay, let's see if I got that. Oh yes, Steve, we already covered you. David says, anthropologists argue for cultural relativity, which seems to be the same as polylogism. True. Well, polylogism, cultural relativity would usually mean something like people's ethical standards are relative to culture. Say, suppose somebody says, is a marriage only between, is it morally all right that a marriage consists of more than two people? So some people would say, that depends on what culture you're in. Say, in our culture, it wouldn't be all right that in some cultures, allow for marriages of more than two people, so it's all right for them. That would be an example of cultural relativism, relativity. But polylogism is a view that people think differently in different cultures. So people would be using, they would be using different logical laws in the different cultures. So that's a more extreme thesis. Okay, Rock says, fast-track theology in its essence is much the same fundamental assumptions of the behavior that are found in very predictable human nature, if you will. I suppose in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths in self-evident, there's certain truths of human nature, but I don't think their founders weren't interested so much in kind of the deductive science of what's involved in the concept of human action. They did believe in fixed human nature, so there's that point of similarity. So I'd say there's some similarity that's not precisely the same thing, but it's a good topic, perhaps might be more further investigation. Now, Dan says, what do you mean by cultural relativity? That would be a good explain. Suppose I say you just asked the question, what do you mean by cultural relativity? Well, what do I need to understand this question? We would normally say, well, I just need to understand what the different words in your sentence mean. But on a culturally relative view, I would have to understand more than that. I would have to understand more than just what the words in your sentence mean. I have to understand what culture you're from. So if you're, say, from a particular culture, your words might mean something other than what they would mean from a different culture. I don't just mean you might be using a different language, but even using the same language, you would have to bring in your culture in order to understand what you're saying, to judge whether what you're saying is true or not. So it's a kind of an unusual view, because normally we think, or at least I believe we think, that in order to see the statement is true, you just have to say, are the facts the way the statement says it? If I say the Earth revolves around the sun, that's true if the Earth revolves around the sun, and false if it doesn't. But on the cultural relativist view, those would be incomplete statements. We have to bring in what culture the person who's making the statement is from in order to judge the truth of the statement. Gerald said, please explain this sentence for me. Fast track theology in its essence is much the same as a fundamental assumption. I just have to go over the chat. Wait, I lost the chat. Let me get that. I've lost the Q&A help. I'm not doing too. How do I get the chat back? I just lost it. I just lost the chat.
David, under participants.
Oh, I see chat. Yeah, I get it. Okay, fine. Thanks. I got it. I think I already covered that one. So it was Mises who made that statement. I was going to the wrong question. Gerald has seen that this stuff for me. For a long time, men failed to realize the transition from the classical theory of values, the objective theory of values, as much more than the substitution more satisfactory theory of market exchange, the less satisfactory one. Again, what is the simple definition of classical theory? Well, classical theory of value is one that explains what the value of a good is by basically what is the cost of producing that thing. How much labor do you have to spend in making something, or how much money do you have to put out in producing something, how much land do you have to use, and so on. So it's an objective theory. So the value of something depends on these objective magnitudes. So what Mises is saying here is when this subjective theory developed in the 1870s by Menger, Walras, and Jevons, were explaining value not in terms of these objective properties of goods, but in terms of people's subjective preferences. And it's not just you're coming up with a theory that explains things better than the previous theory. There's a fundamental revolution in thought, as you say, you're going. You're explaining value not in terms of these objective physical properties of good that are out there, but in terms of how people value it. So it's a whole revolution in thought. So I think that's what he means in that sentence. Okay. David Scott says a 5th century German culture has been alleged to affect the political thought. You consider cultural properties to affect thinking and economics and politics. Well, I mean, that's an interesting hypothesis. There are various psychoanalysts who held that view. So that's the kind of a question worth investigating, but it isn't one that Mises is especially concerned with. He isn't saying, no, it's false that this view of the influence of the father in German culture is the correct one. He's just concerned to deny his polylogism, which is that people have different logical laws or different standards of evaluating the truth of propositions of economics depending on what culture you're in. He's saying propositions of economics are universally true. So this particular hypothesis is one he's kind of neutral on, at least in the book. He might have views about it, but they're not part of that theology. Now, Leslie says any analytic philosophy is trying to apply Mises' theory of human action to ethics. Rothbard in Power and Market does try to come up with what he calls a praxeological ethics, and Hans Hoppe does that also. And I don't think Mises' work has attracted too much attention among analytic philosophy, so I'm not coming up with anyone other than Rothbard and Hoppe. There are philosophers like Roderick Long who know a lot about Mises, but I don't know about direct applications of his theory to ethics. It's an interesting question, but I'm not sure exactly how you go about applying it that way. Sineda, is that the correct pronunciation? Mentioned Tom Topic, I think that's right. Triple H, as I call him. Now here's one. Danny says, "Actually, I'll be based on natural laws or concern with these governing components of natural. Well, praxeology is based just on a logical investigation of concept of action. Natural, it depends, to answer your question, it depends on what you mean. by natural law, if you mean by that some particular kind of ethics based on human nature, it wouldn't be based on natural law. It isn't an ethical system. But if you took natural law just to be something like any statement of scientific regularity, then you could take axiology to be part of natural law in that sense. It would be investigating the concept of action through the regularity. Is there any last question? I think we're about out of time now. We have time maybe for one more if anybody has any last question. Anyone want to let me have it for being missing the time of my own lecture? I never missed my own lecture before. Must be. I'm an old man, you have to forgive me. Well, okay, well, thanks everybody. So,
I could stick around a little bit too if, in case people want to stay late.
Oh, well,